Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode is brought to you by GoToMyPC. You know, a typical work week used to be, what was it, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. But times have changed. Most of us are spending more and more hours stuck in the office. You're missing out probably on some important family events, putting off your personal life. That's why I recommend GoToMyPC to access your office computer from home, so you don't have to be at the office to get your work done. Work at home early and late in the morning, during weekends, after you're done with things you want and need to do. Our listeners can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days. That's a month of unlimited remote access for free, and I recommend it highly. For the special offer, go to www.gotomypc/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free trial. And we thank GoToMyPC for sponsoring this show. Well, howdy, and welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is episode number 135 for the middle of November 2009. And this is your host, country boy Andrew Horowitz, actually kind of a city boy replaced down here in the south, in the south part of New York, it seems, down in Florida. But nonetheless, how are you? And welcome aboard. So I have a couple of announcements and a couple of things I want to tell you about. Two great guests in particular. First, I'm going to have Trader Mark. Mark is a very popular blogger. He is probably, I think, one of the top 10 in the Seeking Alpha overall followed, if you will. And he has a great bit of knowledge, I think. He's a good friend of mine for a while now. We've talked regularly, and I think you're going to enjoy a discussion with him. I know I always do. And then someone who I've only just recently met, but somebody who I've read very often. His name is Tom McClellan, and he has something called the McClellan Oscillator, the Summation Index. Very big on cycles, you know, the 9-month cycle and what that means, and looking at the different market indicators when they coordinate together, looking at the oscillators, seeing where there's divergence. And his particular oscillator, I think, is really interesting to check out. So I think you want to listen to that and stay tuned. So we'll have both of them talking about all the things that are unique in their world and the world of investing. So I think that's going to be a great show here coming up. The other thing I want to mention to you is that we have a couple of different things that I need you to kind of pay attention to. So listen to this. So first, you know what's great? This is good news. The Podcast Awards. Boy, oh boy. I got to tell you something. I am so moved. The Podcast Awards, which are nomination and voting process, I asked you, I think a couple of weeks back on DH Unplugged, we talked about it and put out some blog posts about it, et cetera, some tweets. And if you didn't notice, we actually, all three of my podcasts, The Winning Investor, DH Unplugged, and The Disciplined Investor, we got the People's Choice for The Disciplined Investor, the business and news and all that. So now I ask you, please do me a favor. If you enjoy this podcast, go over to podcastawards.com and vote starting the 13th, which just passed. And go vote and tell your friends to vote. Please tweet it out there. Tell everybody to go vote for The Disciplined Investor or DH Unplugged or The Winning Investor as the top podcast, your favorite. And I would really very much appreciate it. You know, maybe tell some family members, put on your Facebook, you know, spread around, send some emails out. Podcast Awards, vote for The Disciplined Investor for the best, the People's Choice, et cetera, and for the business. The other thing I want to mention to you is, let me just grab this here because this is kind of interesting. On November 17th, next week, there's going to be another Cyber Expo. We've seen this before with Cyber Training University. There's, 6 different teachers, classes, lectures, seminars, online webinars, whatever you want to call it, from day trading and precious metal trading, options, futures, Forex, all sorts of things, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning, going all the way through 4:30 in the afternoon. It's free. And let's see who's going to be there. Thomas Busby from DTI Trader, David Derricott from Metastock. I'll be there at 1:30. In the afternoon. Actually, it's online, so I'm not going anywhere. Dan Cafali, The Wall Street Shuffle, Fausto Puglisi from CyberTrader University, and John Manley from Market Evolution. And I think these, this also, let's see, first it's going to be from Futures, then Trading Systems, Investing Course, that's me, and Gold Trading Course. Then you got Stock Courses, how to do level two trading and day trade and swing trade, and then another options course. So it's all free, and obviously what the whole point is to give you some education here, but also to show you what else is out there, the other classes that go on over at Cyber Trading University. So I think that would be kind of interesting. So let's see, do we talk about anything else? I think we talked about a lot of this information. Okay, the other thing that I want to talk about is where we are. You know, option expiration next week is kind of coming up, and that should add some volatility to these markets. We've seen the VIX, which is the volatility ratio or the fear gauge, if you will, the options gauge of how much concern there is in the future for the markets. It spiked up last week or the week before, and then it came down pretty sharply this week. Interesting, because we are seeing a very interesting divergence here. We're seeing consumer confidence numbers came in pretty lousy. We put a post up on the Disciplined Investor about this. I mean, they looked, you know, more like consumer unconfidence numbers. And, you know, the reason is because obviously, the more people that are out of work, the more there's concern for the present situation. And it's interesting, at the same time, we're seeing the retailers do well. In fact, we bought Sears again for the second or third time recently in our portfolios. And it was up 6.5% on Friday, which is quite amazing if you really think about it. 6.5% for Sears, not the most widely traded, a little illiquid to a point. But yet, at the same time, JCPenney came out with some great numbers. Abercrombie beat as well. And there's been a divergence, a kind of a demarcation between the companies that have really done well with their inventory cycle and those that haven't. One of the other things that happened, I don't know if you heard about this, the whispers, the behind the scenes kind of, hey, have you heard this? But it seems that Goldman Sachs, which GS stands for obviously the government's messenger service, which is what it is starting to talk about another stimulus package that's on the way. And I think it's really interesting if you look at what has been talked about over the week, how the TARP money has been paid back and there's money being made on this right now, which we won't get into that discussion. We're smart enough to really believe all that. But what they're saying is that the TARP money being back, well, why don't we reallocate that into a stimulus package? Well, I could say, why don't we reallocate that into returning it to the rightful owners of the taxpayers who are now bearing the brunt of a major deficit and pay that off, but that would be too logical. The stimulus package that they're talking about would be more of a direct, and I guess it would probably require, if they used TARP monies, would require congressional approval, of course. Just put one more thing on their plate in a time when, oh, look at that, 2010 midterm elections. Maybe that's when they'll actually serve it up. But Goldman Sachs mentioned that, and that put a bid under things, and maybe with the lower consumer confidence and the unemployment rate coming in at 10.2 a week ago, these bad news signs and these really ugly-looking numbers are ammunition enough to get another stimulus package. Now, don't get fooled. It's not the second stimulus package. It's not the third. I think it's close to the fifth at this point. Well, will it work? I guess if you just keep on shoving money into something, they're trying to revive the patient. I guess you just keep shocking it and shocking it and shocking it with those paddles that sooner or later will come back to life, right? I mean, Frankenstein did. So we'll see what happens with that. But I don't want to take up too much time because I do want to spend some time with these two guests, and those run a little bit long. So let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll queue it up with Trader Mark. So before we get to our next guest, I thought it'd be interesting to have a discussion about Audible.com. You know, if you like listening to the podcast and you're kind of like me, I have more time to listen to podcasts than I do to read books. But when I do read books, I love Audible. And, you know, I download them and I listen to them at my leisure when I'm, you know, sometimes when I'm going to work, when I'm kind of resting, when I'm doing some other things. You know, you get to multitask a little bit, and that's why I love Audible.com. They have some great opportunities because they have like 35,000 or 40,000 books right now, and you can actually get a free offer for them just by going to audiblepodcast.com/investor. And, you know, I download a lot of books. I listen to some of them. I kind of listen to others. But I thought, and when I say that, is I kind of listen to a lot of it one time. But I just download this book. It's called Googled: The End of the World as We Know It. And I thought it was kind of interesting. Listen to this preview for a second. This is kind of neat.
That most mysteries, including the mysteries of human behavior, are unlocked with data. Of course, Wall Street's faith in such mathematical models for derivatives helped cripple the American economy. Naivete and passion make a potent mix. Combine the two with power, and you have an extraordinary force.
So it's kind of all about, I guess it's all about, you know, what I find is, you know, the data that's available right now is kind of just amazing, more data than we've ever seen before, that, you know, these mathematical algorithms that have the ability to show what kind of data when people are buying things and where they're going to go, and kind of the whole idea that Google has just so much of it and there's really no secret anymore. But also talks about, you know, the whole idea of what do you do with that data. So anyway, I thought it was a good book. You can get it at audible.com, audiblepodcast.com/podcast. Get a free trial, as a matter of fact, just for going and doing that. And make sure to use the investor as the keyword there. And I thought that that would be something you'd be interested in. But anyway, we thank Audible for their support. And I know you do like these kind of things because everybody writes me all the time. What are you reading? What are you looking at? So we'll put a link on the site as well in the show notes for that. So let's get to our first guest and let's talk to him. I think that you'll find it very interesting. And you know, we have a special guest on today, somebody who's a friend of mine and who is a co-blogger. And his name is Mark Hanna. You may not know that name because usually he goes by the handle Trader Mark. He's one of the most popular bloggers when it comes to Seeking Alpha and the Seeking Alpha 100 or 1000, or he's way up in the top there. And he's a prolific writer. He is a great research analyst when it comes to looking at stocks, not only from a technical standpoint, but also from a fundamental standpoint. And I got to talk to him today because he agreed, and I'm really happy to have you on. Mark, how are you?
Thanks very much for having me, Andrew. Good to talk to you. I've been a longtime reader, and I'm excited to be on the podcast for the first time.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. I mean, it's been a while. We've been talking and kind of been going back and forth on when you're going to be finally be on. So let's talk a little bit. Just give me a little history here. So how did you start blogging? Why did you start blogging? What was the whole, what was the genesis and then the evolution of your blogging?
Sure. Well, I've been involved somewhere on the internet writing, on financial boards, back even to Silicon Investor, for people who know that website, back in the late 90s. So I've always been kind of involved writing on message boards and that sort of thing. But about, 2.5 years, August 2007, before that, of course, a little bit before that, I was thinking about how can I leverage the internet to follow kind of a passion of mine. I wasn't in the financial industry, but I've been interested in the stock market for a long time, 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. And wanted to leverage the internet and say, how can I use it to do this dream of somehow attracting capital and start a mutual fund, which sounds outrageous, but many outrageous things have been done on the internet. So I started a blog, kind of just write my thoughts out, economic-wise, economics, stocks, the market in general, and see what happened, and just gave it a shot. So kind of I ported what I used to do in different places. Like, I even used to be on the Yahoo message boards to some degree, even though that's a crazy place, kind of the wild, wild west, and just kind of said, instead of sparsing my thoughts here, there, and everywhere, I'm just going to have my own home and see if it attracts people.
Now, give people a little bit of backdrop here, the actual place that he blogs is a website called Fund My Mutual Fund. All one big word, Fund My Mutual Fund. And he has pledges that you take in and all that. What's interesting is, let me ask you a question just on that. These days you can actually set up an ETF kind of easily. Is that not something you would want to do?
I haven't looked at it. There's something called an active ETF, which is something that I would be more, most ETFs are pretty passive in terms of
right.
the way they're set up.
Right.
I was contacted by someone that I think their family or their fund family or however you want to call it does do that, but it was the same situation in terms of there would need to be a minimum number of assets and had to be a certain, like a 20 million plus number. So that was more the
well,
issue.
I would offline, we'll get together, we'll talk about it because I know my friend Harry Dent. You know Harry Dent?
Yeah, I know that name.
Yeah, he's been on, he's a good friend. He actually set up a fund, an active traded ETF through a group, and it's actively trading. And I don't think he started with that kind of money. So that,
yeah, I think that just launched. That just launched a couple months ago.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
Something
to look into.
Yeah, something to look into. We'll talk about that offline. But let's talk. One of the things that really excited me about the things that you write is your writing style. A lot of things that you write about, you give a lot of detail. You talk about things. You're a trader. You're not, I wouldn't say, a buy and hold kind of guy. And you do a bit of hedging. You do a little bit of in and out. Sometimes you'll hold if it's right, and you'll fold if it's right also. So what, the last year, 2 years, both of us, you and I, have had a very similar mindset. I think we have, at least.
Right.
And that has been, too much government, too big of a problem, A lot of, I don't want to say cover up and start sounding like we're freaks, but, there's a lot
grassy knoll guy.
Yeah, there's some weird things going on. Let's just say that, right?
There are, yeah.
And we'd rather maybe play with them than fight them because we can't fight them. Yeah. So what's your kind of take these days where we are? Here we are in the middle or the beginning of November 2009. So many things don't even matter. The CIT bankruptcy a couple of weeks ago doesn't even seem to matter. Tell me where we're going. What's happening? Tell me like what you did, the general concept of maybe the mindset that you have now than you did, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago.
Well, it's ironic. On my website, I was writing a lot more maybe about economics when I first started, and I was kind of putting predictions out for 6, 9, 12 months. And when I really sat down and dislocated or thought about all the things that could potentially happen with the housing bust as it was coming, this is 2007 before it was obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I almost didn't believe a lot of things I was writing in terms of, could this really all happen? Could it really get this bad? So as 2008 unfolded, it did get that bad and even worse. And kind of conceptually, someone who really sat down and looked at it could see it coming, but it's almost, you don't believe it because, we didn't live through anything like that. So that's why, you have to give that John Paulson a lot of credit. And there's other people just like John Paulson that have less recognition that not only saw it coming, but then they made the trade. So the reason I'm saying that is as I look forward, I'm really almost saddened by what's happening, to be honest with you. It looks like what we're just trying to do as a country, and I say that from leadership's standpoint, central bank and federal government, is just repeat what we just did, but bigger and better. And because the problems are now so structural and so deep that going back to a quote-unquote normal economy, it would be very painful for the short run. When I say short run, it could be 2 years, 3 years. But we don't want to take that pain, so we're just going to reinflate the entire world
mm-hmm.
and try to get the debt, all things that we are running away from. We're going to try to just go back to the way things were as if nothing has happened. I mean, how do you go from the worst economic situation since the 1930s to, if you believe it, almost back to normal in 6 months.
Well, how about this?
A stress test and some accounting changes, and hey, we're back.
Here's what,
change a couple accounting rules, everything's fine.
Now, you read my piece that I wrote about
a
stress test, right? I mean, I said that, we're at 10.2%. We talked about this last week, I think, on the podcast. That the worst case scenario for the stress test were something like 9.5%, and that was the end of 2010. And that was the worst case scenario for unemployment, and all the banks had been funded properly. And if we got to that point and breached that point, the banks will have to come up with more capital, right? Here's what I find the most amazing. I must have missed something, but are you telling me that all the billions...
What did you see last week, or was it earlier this week? Sorry, I can't keep track of all these updates. They said all the banks other than GMAC are just fine.
And tell me something. Explain
why are you worried? After all, they're telling us everything's fine.
They're all fine. And
Andrew, stop worrying.
I got to get off of this. No, but seriously, listen to this. This is really interesting. So they're all fine, but let's just back up, and then I'm going to ask you another question. So they're all fine, but miraculously, they all recapitalized and are able to essentially pay back billions of dollars. I mean, mega billions of dollars in a matter of 6 months. This has got to be either the best business in the world. I mean, think about that for a second. The best business in the world, or we just transferred all the problems right back to where they were.
Well, a lot of it's been transferred to the Federal Reserve balance sheet,
right,
which we can't see. My contention was, as these things were unfolding, right before Fannie and Freddie, really, I think it was July or August 2008, when we took that over, or when the Chinese asked us to take this over, let's put it that
mm-hmm.
way. Before the bazooka comment by Hank Paulson mm-hmm. is that these things, we have a short attention span in America, let's be honest. Hurricane Katrina is already, that's a different lifetime as far as we're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put these things on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. They can sit there and stew for 10 years, 15 years, and we'll take those losses slowly but surely. Because they're not, it's not a publicly traded institution that has to report every quarter. And I think this is why they're fighting this audit of the Fed, which, I'm in support, I'm sure you are as well. I don't want to speak for you, but I think
no, of course. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing. Not only am I in favor of it, but the Supreme Court's in favor of it, and they're still not doing it.
Right. So, essentially, that's the scam. Let's use the word scam. Let's call it what it is. you know, we're going to take these debts away from these private entities, we're going to put it on the taxpayer, and we're going to slowly, you know, we can print through quantitative easing, or what we're doing right now, you know, the big thing they're doing that nobody talks about is the banks have about their balance sheets have gone up by from literally to $1 trillion from a year ago. It was about $80 billion of reserves, and they're borrowing that from the Fed at 0 to 0.25, and they're just putting that money right back into treasuries. So everybody asks, gosh, wow, these treasury auctions are going great. Who's doing all this buying? Well, the Federal Reserve is doing the buying. They're doing it two ways. Number one, they're doing it through their direct purchases, which everybody knows about, but they're doing it through the banks the other way. They're basically, here, the bank borrow from us at almost nothing, and then you can buy U.S. Treasuries, quote-unquote, risk-free for 2%, whatever, 1.5%, 3%, whatever, whichever
duration they're buying. Yeah, so you get the 2% spread very easily.
Risk-free return. Yeah, yeah. You go and bonus your executives for that great business that any 4-year-old child could run, and then wow, look at all this demand for U.S. Treasury.
Yeah, the bid to cover ratios have been great.
Nobody's worried about it.
Right, crazy.
Right, crazy. So they're getting the income from it. They're slapping each other on the back. That, oh my God, we've recovered and we're geniuses, and then all of the bad debt is just sitting on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. What's gonna happen when they have to sell that back out to the rest of the?
Well, we already know that. We already know that there's been a drop in the demand. I mean, we track that the Treasury buys and how much capital is coming to the U.S. and that's dropping. But let me ask you something. Did you notice this? Let me just back up a second. You said that out of all the banks that were looked at again last week, and they said GMAC was the only one that required possibly an infusion, right? Now, you remember the old show, this is one of these things doesn't belong, one of these things is different. Remember that? What is the one thing different about GMAC versus all the others?
The only thing I know is different is that they're literally funding our car industry.
How about this? Let me give you something better. Right?
Yeah.
They're the only ones that are not publicly traded.
I didn't think about that.
Weird is that?
Yeah. I didn't think about it. You're
that is way too much of a coincidence. Way too much of a coincidence. You know, yours and mine, one of our most least favorite companies. I will tell you that I have an issue. It's like one of those, you know, you got one of those gnawing company issues every once in a while. Capital One is gosh knows why they're still around. You know,
we've had discussions about that one.
I mean, Capital One is an aberration, and obviously, you know, maybe because they sit behind everything else, but between their unsecured credit card debt, you know, obviously they don't have trading like a JP does to make up the difference, nor do they have anything else.
And American Express and Discover, they at least have networks where they're getting like transaction fees.
Right.
Capital One is kind of just just that business.
It's a poster child for bankruptcy.
I'm just amazed. Like in the worst, I'm amazed how few bankruptcies there have been, period, in anything, Andrew. What big names have gone bankrupt? Let's take away Lehman Brothers.
Right.
In any industry, this is the worst downturn, you know, since the 30s. You know, some people say it's not as bad as the late 70s, early 80s. If you really look at the true government data, you know, not adjusted for happiness factor, it is the worst. There's almost no bankruptcies. And that, again, that's all part of this plan, in my opinion. We're going to give leniency to the banks, then the banks don't have to take these hits. The banks don't want to take the hits. They don't want, like, foreclosures, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to take houses back because then they have to admit a defeat. They have to admit losses on their balance sheets. So, if you just read on the internet, you talk people on comment boards. I know this friend of mine has been sitting in a house for 14 months, hasn't made a payment. Why is that? Well, the bank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, whoever it might be, they don't want it. They don't want that house back. For obvious reasons, they have to take the hit,
and they could write
it
down. They could write it down. Then it's toxic assets. Then the toxic asset doesn't matter because it's on the you know, whatever the fair value is. No, that doesn't matter. It's whatever the perceived end value is.
You know the mark to market. I probably should explain this to listeners. There was a big change that pretty much was at right at the beginning of this rally, March. I think it was March or late February, where. There's something called an accounting board, FASB. It's the accounting board that sets the standards in the U.S. at least. And there was political pressure on them to change the fair accounting standards, however you want to call it, about marking assets. And basically what it said was The way things used to be before the change was whatever the market price is, you have to mark to that price, which means if there are 18 houses in your neighborhood and they're all the same house, similar types of house, and the median value of that house has dropped from $400,000 to $220,000, you have to mark on your books that if you sold it today, it would be worth $220,000. And banks were having a lot of tough time with that because that was reality. So the banks argued, said, this is a misnomer. The prices aren't correct. You know, when the prices were high, they were correct, but when the prices are low, they're never correct. So the prices are wrong. We don't want to have these prices. So we're going to go to mark to what I call myth instead of mark to market. And by doing that, it's a lot of obfuscation. It's a lot of Japanization, if you want to call it, doing all the same things, not admitting to what's out there. And from that moment, that accounting rule changed, pretty much has been straight up since then. So there's so many things going on. I mean, literally, we could spend 10 hours on that one topic.
Well, let's talk about what the opportunities are, because here's the point. What we're seeing in this, which is kind of, I would say usual but unusual, is that there have been opportunities. I mean, everybody says, oh my gosh, we have all this unemployment, we have this, we have that. But, where are the opportunities? Well, we're seeing opportunities because what's happening, and we've talked about this ad nauseum on this show, about the layoffs and the continual layoffs. Even we're seeing mass layoffs starting again, which I find really interesting. The big chunky layoffs are starting all over again. Every time a company comes out with earnings, they talk about, this and that, and next quarter, and we're going to lay off, and everybody is all happy.
Things are stabilizing, but we have to let go another 2,000 people.
Yeah,
they're stabilizing.
My favorite phrase is that markets, or economically now, continue to stabilize. How do you continue to stabilize? Either you're stabilized or you're not stabilized. You're either going up or you're going down. But continuing to stabilize,
less stable or more stable,
is not possible. Right. It's just not possible.
Right.
Well,
I know Applied Materials just in the last week. Applied Materials,
yep. Adobe, Sprint,
1800, Adobe. Yeah. So yeah, they're still happening. They're not as hectic as before. I mean, Andrew, there's only so many people in America left to fire.
Right.
One-third, I read about this all the time on the website. I've been writing about it for two and a half years. One-third of our employee base now is what I call government or pseudo-government, which means literally government, like everybody knows, and then healthcare and education, which is basically publicly funded.
But
a lot of healthcare, Medicare, how much is Medicare over the entire healthcare bill? It's a lot. So there's not mass firings happening. Healthcare has added jobs every single month through the worst recession we've had in 7 years. There's never been a drop. Education, there's been some, but the stimulus plan, this year's stimulus plan was basically, a lot of that was a bailout to the states. And again, I have nothing against teachers, but we're running deficits at the state level, and even the administration said last week that 350,000 teacher jobs were saved through the stimulus. That's not stimulus to me. That is just basically plugging in fiscal holes. Stimulus to me is like new jobs, I guess.
And let's not even talk about lotteries and what happened there and how come those aren't paying for the schools, but. I've ranted about this issue, this whole issue. I've ranted and ranted about the saved or create jobs discussion.
Oh gosh, yeah.
It makes me crazy.
It's a big mess. Let's not even go there. But anyways, my point is, what's going to happen eventually, sometime in next spring. We're going to have zero job creation. That's going to be considered a great thing, even though we need 125,000
right.
jobs a month just to keep up with population growth. But the reason is, we've been bloodletting for 2 years now, and there's, like I said, one-third of the jobs in America are basically protected. There's an iron shield around them.
Right.
That's the public and pseudo-government. The other two-thirds are private, and unfortunately, they are, they're at risk to the free market. And so, at some point, these companies, they can't cut more people because there's nobody left. You saw the productivity numbers, I think it was 2 weeks ago or one
yep.
week ago. 9.8%
out of control. Unbelievable.
It's amazing. I mean, so there's people that have jobs, they know they're at risk, so they're working.
You kind of see
jobs,
Do you have the image that there's a guy standing on top of a platform in each of these factories with a whip? Doesn't that productivity number give you that kind of impression?
Well, I have a cartoon that I always post on my website that was like, there's kind of a lady leaving her job. She's getting fired, and it's like a four-panel cartoon. The last panel is, I only wish I had two jobs to give to my economy or to my country.
Right.
You know, two jobs to lose.
Right.
So we're gonna run out of jobs, and that's what I'm saying. It is amazing. You're still seeing, you know, they're not 20,000 jobs at a time, but you're still seeing 1,800, 2,500. And the real reality you're not seeing, I'm not seeing, you're not seeing is the damage in the small businesses.
Right.
That's where 67% of the jobs are in the private industry, and you know, due to the lack of credit, due to lack of demand. By debt-laden consumers, you know, those businesses are just are shutting down left and right. You don't hear them. That's 8 people here losing a job, 22 people here losing a job, 15 people here losing a job. So yeah, we're gonna have the end of this. Wall Street's gonna celebrate when, you know, we have zero job creation, and then we're gonna be into the next jobless recovery.
Well, last week they celebrated a 10.2 number, but let's get off the unemployment. Let's talk about where the opportunities are for a second. I know that you do a lot of trading, and the opportunities are could be anywhere. It could be under any rock for a buy if it's moving down. Now, here's what I've noticed, and tell me what you think. This is very simplistic, but this is what I've noticed. It seems like there is a magic a potion, if you will, or a magic a strategy. If a stock moves down quickly, it stops at its 50. First, it stops at 20. It stops at its 50, and it does a major bounce. Have you noticed this?
A lot of times, yep.
And it's like it's almost like there's a program. I mean, there is obviously, but there's a program being put in that, you know, that's what's going to happen, and that's where the buying comes in, and you get massive rebounds. I saw that recently on a few different positions, and even the markets, the S&P 500 bounced off, but then it bounced below, but then it had a recapture somehow. So what is that all about?
We've had V-shaped. You know, again, if any listeners. Are unfamiliar with technical analysis, some of this might not make much sense, but
well, I present to you that we know about technical analysis, and some of this doesn't make sense.
No. the things we're seeing, I'm not doubting that. I'm just
right.
for the few that might
right.
not. We're seeing things on the technical analysis side. You know, again, I started doing this without, you know, in the mid late 90s without knowing anything about technical analysis, and after I thought I was a genius in 99 like everybody else,
mm-hmm.
and then I got my behind handed to me in 2000, 2001. I had to learn over from scratch, and I started getting technical analysis into my arsenal. So I've been doing it since 2002 forward. So I've seen a lot of things, and I haven't seen anything like what's been happening lately where you have these big sell-offs on volume, and then, again, all our rallies are in very late volume, but there's no consolidation. It's just straight down. In a very short period of time, and not very, you know, 3%, 4%, 5% down on an index and more on individual stocks, but you don't rest. You just turn around the very next morning. You have no memory of what just happened, and it's straight up, not for one session, for about 5-7 sessions straight up. If that happens once a year, you're kind of shocked. We're getting them now on a monthly
They're all the time.
Yeah, the exact same pattern. So I don't know what's going on. I mean, I have my, you know, we have our suspicions as grassy knoll inhabitants, what is going on, but it's just not normal. And a lot of people that I know that I've been reading for a long time who use technical analysis, either full-time or part-time, they are completely befuddled. And this is a great market for Mr. Buy and Hold. I never sell. I love markets that go up. He feels like a genius again, just like he did in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who look at patterns, or history, you're like a blind monkey out there
right
now. It's just like, what the heck's going on?
Fundamentals
why is
also.
Why is nothing conforming to past
yeah.
patterns?
So what is the, give me a stock, for example, that just, it doesn't really matter the name particularly, but just tell me, like, for example, what you do for research, and pick a stock, and we'll talk about that, and that you maybe like, and something that you've looked at, and, you know, kind of what are the things that bring you to actually either buy, not buy, or short the stock?
Wow. Geez, I have a whole bunch of different ones. There's a great stock in Brazil. I like international stocks a lot.
You're going to talk about GFA?
No, I was going to talk about GFISA.
Yeah, GFA, right?
Yeah, GFA. Yeah. Okay, you gave me the symbol.
GFA.
Yeah, GFISA.
I like that.
Are you familiar with it?
Well, I'm very familiar with it because we had a buy right under where it went to when it slammed down 2 weeks ago, and I think you got it.
Can't wait that long.
No, I'm saying we had the buy. It was just under where it should have been. I mean, it was just a little bit under...
Yeah.
Where I thought it would go to, and then we just missed it.
Right. Well, that happens. I mean, that happens to all of us. I've been in and out of this stock for many years, 3 years, 2 years.
Now tell them about the stock, what it does, and the name again.
Yeah, well, it's very simple to explain. It's basically a home builder in Brazil.
Right.
I mean, there are so many positives going for. I mean, and the home builders on the Brazilian index, it's the only one that's available to American investors as an ADR. But there are about five or six, you know, major ones in Brazil, and, you know, five of them are only available to Brazilians in Brazil. But this is the one that we can get in America, and all of them have been up 100, 125% mm-hmm. this year. So it's not that I chose the right one. It happens to be, I believe, the second largest, and they've made a very large purchase in the low-income housing area. There are many, many positives. You know, just give you an example. You know, I'm a hybrid investor, technical and fundamental. Mm-hmm. From the fundamental point of view, credit is something we take for granted in the United States, and something people who are investing overseas, especially in emerging markets, need to realize. What we take for granted is something that's just being established in many countries. So a mortgage, you know, a mortgage has been here for decades. Real estate transactions used to be all cash in, you know, most of South America and Central America. That's been changing over the past 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, accelerating every year. And just imagine how big your potential pool of potential buyers are if instead of saying you have to bring 100% cash to the table to buy a house, you can finance it, you know, to whatever degree, even 50% or mm-hmm. 70% mm-hmm. or 40%.
Right.
So, you know, first of all, Brazilian is pretty much in the sweet spot of the world. They are China's supplier of commodities in many, many areas. I'm not going to go, you know, too in depth.
Boy, did they do a sweet deal with China on oil?
On everything, you know, they have iron ore. Mm-hmm. They have oil. Petrobras is probably the best positioned mm-hmm. Company in the world, private company in the world in oil. It has so many. It's basically very similar to Canada, Australia.
Australia, I was going to say Australia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Australia is another one.
Right.
So you have a general increase in wealth in the country. You have a middle class that's growing. It's what I say to people. It's like the 1950s America.
I would agree.
It's a great, even China is like a 1960s America. You have a chance to play the modernization a second time around. You know, I'm only in my 30s. I think you're a little older than me. You know, I think 65 is it, Andrew?
Yeah,
somewhere
I'm an old
there.
Bastard. old grouchy. So, yeah, I'm in my 40s.
We weren't investing in the 50s and 60s, so we didn't have those opportunities. So now we're getting a second chance for people of our generation to do this in other countries. And then I want to stress to anybody listening is you. Don't be afraid. You know, we're very U.S.-centric here. Everything is the United States. Everything, you know, we're number one, this sort of thing. I understand all those things, but you just have to be diverse, and there's so many growth opportunities outside.
The only problem with the Brazil is, as we've seen the last few weeks, I think very interesting, they first of all put a 2% tax, which is interesting. Okay. Yep. Everybody says, who cares? They put a 2% tax. You're going to make a lot more money anyway. But they're trying to slow down. That's their goal. That's a bigger picture. Number two, the other the issues, they're very, very, very dependent on oil. The Brazilian market will go up and down with oil because the Petrobras is there.
Trade.
Yeah, it's a commodity. But it's really also because the country really relies on the Petrobras. And the other thing is...
It does rely on...
Right?
Yep. But,
yeah, the other thing is the dollar. The dollar starts going up. This thing is in big trouble from a perspective of differential. Right now, the Brazilian dollar is like up 50% comparatively to the dollar in the last like year.
Yeah, it's that's the reason they're doing this 2% tax is thanks to Ben Bernanke, the world is getting flooded with dollars. Taiwan did a similar thing, I think, yesterday or 2 days ago, that these countries that are not pegged to the dollar, like China doesn't have this example because they've been pegged.
Right.
They are seeing huge capital inflows because all these U.S. dollars, there's no need for them in the real economy in the United States because the real economy is very, very weak. There's, you know, the debt to income ratio is still a stratospheric.
Mm-hmm.
We are bribing people to buy cars. We're bribing them to buy first time houses. You know, there's just no end demand short of bribing everybody, you know, with handouts.
Right.
So the idea what the Fed's trying to do is, we're going to create a lot more money, throw in the system, and my textbook says here that the banks are going to lend this out to people, and everything will be back to normal. But the problem with that is the people don't want the money. I mean, a lot of people, some of the small businesses they do, but the end consumer doesn't really need it, and that's where everything starts.
Well, they're afraid of getting into the same rut again.
Yeah, and this money now, because there's no need for it, I mean, there is some need. There's not as much need as what's being created for in the quote-unquote real economy. It's going into the Wall Street economy, and that can very easily transfer from Rio de Janeiro to Moscow to Shanghai in seconds nowadays. So the whole world is getting flooded. There was a great Wall Street Journal report today. I don't remember the title of it, but it was literally every country in the world is trying to get the dollar to go up, except for us,
right,
of course.
Right. Although Geithner said that the strong dollar policy is, of course.
Don't start with that.
Let me ask you. So now, let me ask you this. He who talks with forked tongue, I think it is, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
What is the GFA? So you like the fundamentals on it, okay? When is it that you're in and out of it? I mean, what is your signals on that? How do you work with that?
Yeah. I tell you. It's been with almost every stock now. I mean, it's kind of very simple, and I hate saying that because the stock market is not a simple thing, but it's been very easy lately just because you buy every dip, and that's kind of, it's a religion now, buy every dip.
Yeah, until the one dip that nails you.
Absolutely. That's going to fail eventually. I mean, that's going to fail. When it does fail, so many people are doing this, it's going to be
a
splendid firework.
Yep.
And it all has to do with the dollar. Like, going back to the dollar, everything now is turned into a dollar trade. U.S. dollar goes up, even intraday now. The U.S. dollar goes up at 10 o'clock, everything sells off. U.S. dollar drops at 2 p.m., everything goes up. And like I said, yes, that's the problem with Brazil, China. They're all tied into this as well. It's just amazing. The correlations are just, something we have not seen
before. Because I think one of the things that's happening is a lot of the banks, for example, that took this money and doing this gigantic carry trades, whether it's a carry trade traditionally with currency to currency, or it's a carry trade, for example, where they're using borrowing the dollars, I think what's happening is the leverage is so great with the dollar carry trade right now that when the dollar goes up, if you think about this for a second and kind of envision what I'm saying here, if you have a leveraged account, let's say you margined 4-to-1 for a triple leveraged ETF, okay? Every little move is exaggerated.
Start going against you. You have to worry. You just have to start worrying.
It's quick. So the thing is, what if the carry trades that are being done and the banks in particular that are using, as you said, the funding from the government to get a 2% spread, but yet they're taking the money and they're putting it somewhere else, maybe not only in treasuries, but they're putting it somewhere else and in large amounts of money, okay? And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're borrowing on the dollar. What if that is so leveraged that their moves are exaggerated in such a way that they have to kind of keep pulling in and out of different markets, and that's why we're seeing these exaggerated drops when the dollar moves up? Because the dollar historically has not had a correlation with the markets like it has now. It's like almost ridiculous. It's a new phenomenon.
Yeah, and there's been times it's been the opposite, actually. Like, when the dollar is strong, you know, generally that's good for America. Now it's kind of, we quote-unquote want, other than, you know, lip service saying that we want a strong dollar. You know, the dollar is down 40% this decade, while four Treasury secretaries have repeated what Geithner said today.
we say
one thing, but watch what they do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is more of a recent phenomenon, and I think it's become kind of a lot of trades, which, as you know, they are based in good fundamentals, but as they become extended, they become a cult. And then when the cult buying is done, there's an explosion, and that's kind of what I would say with, like, oil last year. The fundamental reason that was true was, you know, we have 2.5 billion new consumers eventually in India and China. You know, say 400 million of that are going to eventually be true middle class. Therefore, there's only so much oil in the world, blah, 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 blah. But that explains oil going from 40 to 80, maybe. That doesn't explain 40 to 150 in two, 3 years. So what happens is the trade is correct for the first, say, third to half. Then it's all the hedge funds piling, all the institutional money. Every Tom, Dick, and Jerry wanted to be in, was telling me, you know, the barber's telling you about the great NASDAQ tips in 1999. Everybody was a commodity trader last summer. So that last $40, $50, you know, which is that euphoric, spike at the very end.
Right.
That's not based in reality anymore.
Yep.
So now what's happening with the dollar carry trade is everybody's on that cult of every single time there's a downtick in the dollar, anything can be bought. I'm bulletproof.
Right.
And everybody believes that. It's going to keep going until it doesn't. And that sounds like a ridiculous statement, but anybody who's been in markets for a while knows that's the
exactly
truth.
Exactly right. The market
We don't know when it ends.
The market
will
end.
And it will end badly. It always does. So at some point here, you know, I watch the dollar every day. You have to now, and you know it can't even get a bid for 4 days in a row. I mean, it's a miracle if it goes up 4 days in a row.
But once it does go up and breaks, if it does, I mean, we're going to see a lot of carnage. I mean, just look at what happened.
Right, right.
Let's look what happened at the earlier part of November. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, and actually the end of October. I mean, it was ugly. I mean, I looked at my screen one day. I said, what is that? Oh, my watch stops. No, I said, ugh.
Yeah, it's already forgotten that there was a sell-off like 2 or 3 weeks ago. We've been straight up since then. Yeah. But the first sign of that was there was an intraday reversal. It was Wednesday or a Thursday.
No, that was a Monday. That was a Monday.
No, it was late. It was a Wednesday, Thursday, I think. There was intraday reversal in the last 45 minutes of the session. The dollar just shot up, and the S&P was up like 1, and it finished at negative 0.5 or something like that. So it dropped a 1.5% in 45 minutes. Then 2 days later,
we
rallied in like the first hour and a half. That was a Friday, I remember. And then again, the exact same trade happened around 11:30. We dropped 2% in the next 2 hours, and it was just the exact reversal.
Do you know what happened that day? We found out there was 140,000 SPU futures traded, sold.
That's every day, though.
No. That's within. No. That was a $9 billion trade within 10 minutes.
Yeah, no.
That dropped it pretty hard.
Who does that? Who does that, Andrew?
It was actually, I'm admitting it right now, it was me. Okay? It was me. And that was my personal money.
You have a bigger firm than I thought.
Unbelievable. So,
are you hiring?
Yeah, exactly. So this is what I'm going to do. We're going to end it here because we could talk for hours, you and I. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to do a chart for me in Trader Mark way of GFA. We'll put it on the show notes of this, and we'll give people a direct link to your site who hasn't been, you know, reading your stuff, because they'll be hooked immediately through your RSS feeds and through your writings, etc. And I think that, you know, I encourage everybody to check it. He's again, writes a lot during the day on a lot of different subjects. And I think you'll really enjoy a lot of his work because it's a very thoughtful, and it's a much different than I think you've read before if you haven't read him, Trader Mark. So get me that GFA chart. We'll put it on the site, and we'll put some links up there. And I thank you very much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
I appreciate the time, and I'm sure we'll be talking in the future.
Absolutely. Andrew. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon, buddy. Bye-bye. As I talked about in the beginning of the show, we have another individual that I want to introduce to you. His name is Tom McClellan, and he writes a market report, a newsletter, if you call it, called the McClellan Market Report. And I got to tell you something. He has a variety of different editions. This is good stuff. This is stuff that you really want to absorb and listen to because, Tom, I'll tell you something. I've read a lot of your work, and you are a smart guy. You are a smart guy, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for the compliments.
So tell me a little bit about, take me a little bit back to how you developed this process, you know, the different indicators and all that.
It goes way back beyond me. People may, in your listening audience, may have heard of the McClellan Oscillator and the McClellan Summation Index. Those are indicators that were developed by my parents back in 1969. I can't claim any credit because I was still in the fourth grade at the time. But my father was a business major, business and economics major at what back then was Claremont Men's College. Now it's Claremont McKenna College. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a math major at Pomona College, and they met there together. And so it actually took the talents of both of them to figure out these tools. It looks at the number of advancing issues and declining issues every day on the NYSE or any other market or any other collection of stocks that you can name. But it does some exponential smoothing on that data to try to figure out what the acceleration is in the AD data. Mm-hmm. And
why is that important? Why is the advanced decline data, for example, important in your opinion?
Well, it's a great question. Advanced decline data is the best best proxy we have for what liquidity is doing. I call it a liquidometer. Liquidity is a unitless vapor. You can't measure liquidity, you can only describe it. It's like the wind.
Right.
You can't see the wind, you can only see the trees being bent by the wind. Liquidity is essential for a healthy stock market, and when liquidity is strong, when there's plenty of money to go around, what happens is that the majority of stocks will go up. That's because when you have a whole bunch of money wanting to come into the market all at once, it cannot fit into a small number of stocks. It's got to flow everywhere, like mm-hmm. The rising tide's got to lift all boats.
Right.
When liquidity starts to dry up, it may not be reflected yet in the major averages because the big stocks can still garner their share of liquidity. They can hog up all of it available to them, but the little stocks start to suffer. And there's more little stocks than there are big stocks. So when you look at the advanced decline numbers, you'll get the best indication of whether liquidity is strong or weak, more than you can get from looking at price data. And if you can look at the acceleration that is taking place in that liquidity measure, then you can get an edge. You can get an idea ahead of time before it actually shows up on a chart of the advanced decline line.
So when you're looking at the McLellan oscillator, I have one in front of me from your daily edition that you prepared on Wednesday as an example. And these are actually these are the daily ones that you put out. You put out also a biweekly, much more thorough, if you will, or much more thick discussion.
Well, we started out back in 1995 publishing a twice-monthly newsletter, and it was all printed and mailed because that was how you did business back then. And, you know, we used to sit around the dining table stuffing and folding and labeling and stamping and trying to get it all out to everybody. And,
right.
And my kids are really good at putting stamps on things.
They learned that, huh?
Best in the service. But now, electronically, we can get things out much faster.
Right.
But, and actually, if people want to see a chart of the McLellan oscillator, they can go to our website and see one right on the homepage every day, and it gets updated in the afternoon with the closing numbers.
And what is the website? Let's give them the website.
Well, think of the word McLellan oscillator, which is a big, long name for something.
It's big.
We just shortened it to Mick oscillator. It's like a McNugget. It's MCOSCILLATOR.com.
And we'll put that. We'll put that on the website.
You can publish that on the notes page,
yep.
I guess.
Yep. Now, I want to ask you this. So I'm looking at this right now. As of a couple days ago, the one I'm looking at, the hard copy in front of me. And, of course, the McLellan oscillator is a bit more jumpy than the summation index, which we'll talk about. But right now we're seeing we'll call it lower highs and lower lows, right? Would you say that's consistent with what you see from April?
That's true, yes.
Does that mean anything?
Everything means something.
Well, I mean anything that we need to know.
The McLellan oscillator is like any oscillator. There's lots of different ones that technicians use, and they all share common traits. One thing is that they all have a neutral level. So from the McLellan oscillator, it's zero. For a stochastic, it would be 50, for example. Or for RSI, it'd be 50. Those are all oscillators also.
Mm-hmm.
All oscillators can show an overbought reading or an oversold reading, and many of them will also show you a divergence. Those are the main things that you would ever use an oscillator for.
Right.
So if the McLellan oscillator is above zero, it's saying that positive acceleration is taking place in the advanced decline statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's below zero, then it means negative acceleration or breaking force is taking place. And that can either be going down faster or putting the brakes on going upward, one or the other.
Do you recall a time historically when there was this much of these, we'll call it parabolic in a way, in terms of when it goes up, right? I mean, these up and down jagged movements of the oscillator, has that happened regularly or is it more so now?
That's pretty normal.
Yeah.
You don't ever have the stock market go up in a straight line. There are many cycles that are at work across many time frames, and so those things will show up if the indicators that you use are tuned correctly to identify them. When you see a nice oversold reading in the oscillator, like we saw back on October 28th and 30th, well below zero, down around minus 350 is as low as it got. That's a pretty juicy situation where you've seen downward acceleration that is so rapid that it is unsustainable. You just cannot keep the market or the advanced decline statistics going downward that far, that fast, all at once without some sort of snapback. That doesn't mean that the snapback has to turn into a new full-fledged uptrend, but the snapback itself can be worth playing if you're nimble enough and can jump in and out. And fortunately, in the last couple of weeks, we've been able to do that.
And what's interesting, if I recall, right before that happened, you were talking about a very interesting topping formation, and you didn't believe that that was going to be a very deep and a consistently or elongated downdraft at the time. I think you wrote that.
Well, we are looking for topping structures now and a correction into a cycle low that's due in December. And we are not looking for a lot of damage in the stock market between now and that December low. And just for your readers, if they want to mark it on their calendar, December 11th is our target date for the low, plus or minus a little bit, because there's a little bit of noise that can creep in, but that's what we're tracking now. And the reason that we're not looking for a lot of damage is that coming out of the March low earlier this year, we have seen incredible strength in the stock market, and especially incredible strength in the advanced decline statistics. The Dow and the S&P have just now recently gone all the way up and touched the 50% retracement level of their decline from the 2007 high. They've just now completed a 50% retracement.
Mm-hmm.
But the advanced decline line is almost back to its all-time highs. In other words, the breadth numbers have been stronger than the price indices.
Hmm.
And what that means is that all the money that the Fed has been printing which is terrible for a lot of other things, but it has been great for stock prices, and that's the sort of condition that doesn't go away immediately. When you get that much liquidity all flowing into the market, it's a condition that tends to persist for a while.
I wonder what would happen when they pull back. I mean, that's why the market seems to be really jumpy lately. And, you know, it does seem that obviously liquidity has gotten in there. And, you know, whether or not there's also been the addition individually of stocks cutting back dramatically, companies cutting back on expenses, obviously, and that's where they're getting it. It just seems to be that at this point there needs to be continuation of this cycle. And it is obviously pushing up things like gold that you've talked about. And you said that, you know, gold was – I think you're looking also for a gold low and then – a metals rise, and when I say metals, let me rephrase that, commodities starting to rise into December and then into the first quarter of 2010. That's what you just talked about recently in your report.
Well, a lot of questions there. Let's go through them one at a time. All the money that the Fed has been creating has been wonderful for the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
It is terribly problematic for a bunch of other things, but for the moment, for right now, for stock investors, it's helping push up stock prices, and it's not done flowing into the stock market yet. There is more to come after we get through this normal cyclical down move into December. There is still more liquidity out there. We still have not yet felt the full effects of all the Fed's monetary stimulus on the markets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a terrible thing to do that much monetary stimulus, and we're going to be feeling the after effects of it for many years to come, because when you inflate the money supply by 30%, you cannot get away with it not causing price inflation somewhere down the road.
Right.
It hasn't shown up in a lot of things yet, but already crude oil prices have doubled from their low, and if you look at inflation in some other way that we look at it, we're not having negative inflation now like everybody talks about. So in that sense, it's a rough thing. It's a terrible thing. But if we just put on our stock trader hat right now, it's a really good thing for stocks,
mm-hmm.
for right now and for continuing into 2010. When we get off the all miracle grow all the time diet that the Fed has put us on sometime later in 2010, it's going to be terribly problematic. If you think of it like your rose bushes out in the garden, if you feed them Miracle-Gro all the time, every day, they're going to do great until you stop feeding them Miracle-Gro, and then there's not going to be any organic nutrients from mulch or decaying worms or whatever up mm-hmm. in your garden to keep them going.
Right.
So as long as you're all Miracle-Gro all the time, it's great. But when you cut off that food supply, we're going to have even worse problems because the market has gotten to where it can only exist on the Fed's manna, and it doesn't have any of its own organic nutrients.
That's kind of spooky. So you also talk about cycles. You're big into the cycle discussion. As a matter of fact, my co-host on DH Unplugged talks about the cycles and these very long cycles, some of the shorter cycles. I think that recently you were talking about the nine-month cycle.
The nine-month cycle is a wonderful tool that's helped us a lot over the years. It's a squirrely tool because it has some funny behavior traits that not everybody understands the way that we do. It stopped working completely in the 2007 and 2008 period. Just went away because there were other forces that were stronger than that took over. We believe it's starting to work again. That the March low this year that we saw is the first low, and that 9 months later we should be seeing the next episode of the 9 month cycle low coming sometime in December. And using other tools than just a cycle length is what's honing us in on December 11th. But December sometime is when the next nine-month cycle lows do. The nine-month cycle is also unique in that it usually has one bottom, but it has two tops, sort of like a two-hump camel,
right,
if you can imagine that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's the relationship of those two tops that tells you what's ahead. If you see the first of the two tops higher than the second one, that's a bad sign. That's
mm-hmm.
what we call left translation on a chart.
Right.
And it's a bad sign because you're more likely to do a lot of damage on the next downwave. What we've just had this year is extreme right translation, where the right hump is much higher than the left hump. We had a little mid-cycle low in July, and so we're looking for an ordinary, normal cycle correction into December. But because the right-hand hump is so much higher, that portends really nice things for the future and says that the correction down into December should not exceed the level of the low that we saw in July.
Which is, from here, we're talking about somewhere about 10%, something like that.
Not too bad.
Right.
Just a normal, ordinary garden variety correction, but it should feel awful. It should feel gut-wrenching. Everybody should start talking about the double dip, and we're going back to all the way down to 7,000. You know, it should feel like that. And once you get everyone in the street convinced that the sky actually is falling, then the work will be done, and we can start going up again.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that there's been a very big differential between the markets, you know, when to pick your poison, whichever that is, the S&P, the Russell, whatever, and individual stocks. I mean, individual stocks have, you know, like in the material sector in particular, when you get any kind of a downdraft, I mean, they get whacked.
There's a real important point that your listeners need to understand, and a lot of people don't really understand. Fundamentals of a company, the earnings, the dividends, the value, the book value, all those things matter when you're talking about valuing one company versus another company within mm-hmm. the same sector. Mm-hmm. Those are really important. But when you're talking about the overall market and what the overall market's going to do, there are really only two fundamentals that matter. And here's what they are. Number one, how much money is there? And number two, how much does that money want to be invested?
Yeah.
Everything else is secondary.
Right.
And now, if you create so much excess money like the Fed's been doing, then it really doesn't matter how much it wants to be invested. It's all got to find its way to the market, regardless how anybody feels, and that's going to push stocks up, as we have just seen.
So you also do, tell us a little bit about the summation index, because I think that's one of your longer-term, the tools that you use. It's the use of the McClellan oscillator, but you're using it in a different way to give you a much more smooth look at what's happening.
That's true. The McClellan summation index is an insight that my mother actually came up with. She was a math major and had studied calculus. And if you remember in high school where you were studying calculus and you had to measure the area under the curve, that was, you know, you're doing integral calculus. That's kind of the thinking that she approached to it. They had first developed the oscillator and said, well, what's the area under the curve of the McClellan oscillator? And that's what the summation index is. All it really is an indicator that changes every day by the value of the McClellan oscillator. So if, for example, we have a plus 100 McClellan oscillator, that means the summation index goes up by 100 points that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to smooth out what the oscillator is doing. The higher the oscillator goes, the faster the summation index will rise. The summation index is also an oscillator because it has a neutral level, and it gets overbought, and it gets oversold, and it shows divergences. So it's wonderful for that, but there's some additional things that it can show you when you learn how to read it correctly.
I think that when you were, when we look back to the March lows, at that time you had talked about something to the effect of that the McClellan Summation Index only hit, historically only got below, I think it was 2,000, was that the number? Only a couple of times in history?
Well, there's a couple of different versions of the summation index, and so if you start talking about actual numbers, then we got to take a pause for a moment.
Let's just say then the lowest in history. You know, just kind of.
It was not the lowest in history because there were some lower readings back in 1932.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
But it was pretty darn low. And at some point when you get low enough, it really doesn't matter how low it was compared to something else. It's mm-hmm. like the difference between falling off a 12-story building and falling off a 15-story building.
Yeah.
The effect is pretty much the same.
Right.
but you're really, really low. You've had extreme downward acceleration. But by the March low, the summation index was actually making a higher low than it made back in October and November of 2008. It was saying that by March, even though the price indices were falling to lower levels, we were not getting the same sort of downward acceleration because the bears had such a great run, they were getting exhausted. They just couldn't push it down as fast as they used to be able to push it down.
Right.
And that's a diminishing of downward acceleration is what sets you up for the possibility of upward acceleration.
And where are we now? We're talking about middle of November.
The summation index has made nice high values earlier this summer, showing really nice upward acceleration. It's back down almost to neutral, and it's probably going to fall down well below neutral by the time we get to December, which will set up for a nice upward move. In fact, what the summation index has been doing after declining about halfway to neutral is forming a ledge. We like to say that a ledge is something to fall off of.
Mm,
and
right.
even though the market's up today on Friday, as we're recording this, we're still in the middle of a sideways process. It's going to start falling downward into December.
Hmm, interesting. So what are the things that you look at that you find very interesting? I know that you've looked at the interesting, I think you wrote about how there's a divergence right now in consumer confidence and confidence in general and where the markets are going. And that is an interesting divergence that you've seen only a number of times over the last couple of years. And that usually also comes to a market that is maybe looking a little bit out of whack.
Some interesting data that we've come across recently from Rasmussen's poll numbers. they do some economic polling in addition to their political polling, and they're doing some really interesting insights. They'll, for example, break down the data on economic confidence into two different piles. They'll look at what the investors are saying versus the non-investors. And the investors actually are not the smart money. It's kind of funny. The investors tend to get more excited at tops and more depressed at bottoms because probably because they're tuned into it more and listening to it more, and so their emotions vacillate more wildly. But in terms of just general economic confidence about the future, people are less confident now about the future, of what the future holds, than they were a month ago. And yet, stock prices are higher. Now, usually stock prices and economic confidence in this in these poll numbers will move together, as you'd expect. You'd expect that when the market's up, people feel better. When the market's down, people feel worse. That's the normal relation. When you get a condition where the market's up higher but confidence is lower, that's irrational.
Yeah.
People are bidding up stocks even though they think the future is going to get worse. And when we've seen those sorts of divergences in the past, you get a condition where the market suddenly realizes that it's high and doesn't deserve to be, and that it should fall back down to get back over to where it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, Tom McClellan, I want to tell everybody that, first of all, I think that your tools, we'll call them indicators and tools, are just fabulous, and they're a great tool in addition to your toolbox for investing, obviously. And if you want to check it out, just we'll put a link on the show notes. Go over to his website, and you can find that. There's also a free, I think, is it daily that you put out a free commentary?
Well, we have a twice-monthly newsletter and a daily edition. Those are both subscription products, but we have a free service that we just started on our website. It's a free weekly chart in focus. We take a look at one particular chart that may have something instructive generally or about the current market, and people can sign up to get that free, delivered by email, no strings attached, no spam, no blast of marketing, or you can just read it on the website also.
I would encourage you, though, for, I think, $195 for the biweekly. That is some great information piece, and I mean, for under $200, I mean, really, some of the information that you put in there, it covers all avenues, whether it's gold, whether it's the markets themselves, divergences, gives your timing models. I got to tell you something, it is really spooky how close your timing models come to the reality. You know that, right?
Yeah, those are some predictive tools. That's a technique that I discovered before I ever got into this business. I was still a captain in an Army helicopter in the United States Army. Playing around with the tools that my parents developed, and ran across a little mathematical trick that results in predictions of future price turning points, and it's kind of fun.
Honestly, it's a little weird. I mean, so it's good. I mean, it's just, you know, you look at it, wow, that's close. I mean,
and the only inputs are price, time, and algebra. There's no planets, there's no pig entrails or voodoo or anything else like that. It's all math.
Wow.
But it
Amazing.
Works.
Very cool. Well, I thank you for joining us, and I appreciate you coming on, and I do encourage everybody to check out what he has, because it is really truly one of the top end products, and like you said, there's no voodoo, and at the same time, he shows you right, he kind of puts his cards out on the table and tells you where he is in his timing models and what has happened, where it went off, where it went right, what he did wrong, but what he did, you know, it's just great stuff. Good information in the toolbox. So Tom McClellan, thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Great to be with you.
All right, buddy. See you soon. Bye-bye. That was great stuff. I mean, talk about a very bright guy with just an amazing mind for math and, you know, understanding and figuring out these cycles. Really quite impressive, Tom McClellan. So I would encourage you again to check out some of the work, because I think that if you look at the oscillators and the summation index, it gives you some really good, interesting reviews and looks at the general markets, and particularly the one I use a lot is the NASDAQ, the NYSE, and the Dow. But if you compare that and maybe look at a stochastic as an example with different when you create your stochastic, whether it's a slow or fast or any type of other oscillator, you know, you can work the numbers to make it do anything you want it to do, really. But these seem to be really tweaked, and I would encourage you to put maybe a McClellan oscillator next to the stochastic on the NYSE or the Dow or the S&P, and take a look at the turning points and see what that looks like. It's kind of an interesting derivation of the same idea, but using different things, the advanced decline line. Anyway, thanks for joining me today. For those of you who didn't totally get my push in the beginning of the show, please vote for us at the Podcast Awards, podcastawards.com, and Disciplined Investor, DH Unplugged. If you haven't taken a look at that podcast, myself and John C. Dvorak talk weekly. And then there's also, of course, the Winning Investor for you to enjoy as well. If you're interested in understanding how we manage money, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll put a link in the show notes where you can watch our 14-minute video. We call that the virtual tour of our strategy, and I think you'll enjoy it and see how we really allow for investors to understand what we're doing all the time by having a transparent platform where you can see what's going on. We explain what's going on with your investments. No more hidden kind of, no looking, no peeking. You can't know what the secret recipe is. So check that out. And until then, we'll see you next week. Have a great week. Have a successful week. And make sure that you are investing wisely and with discipline. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me here. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.